You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
Our shapeshifter today is one I've had a conversation before, and it gives me such great pleasure to be talking to him once again. It is Elder Obed Chakarisa, and he is the executive manager for standards and compliance at Fly Safair Airline, right? And he describes himself as an entrepreneur at heart, and I will be unpacking what that actually means, and he's joining us on the line. Good evening, my elder.
Good morning. Good evening, Tapelo, and thank you again for having me on your show.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. How was your day?
Oh, today was hectic.
Yeah.
But good. It's good to be having a hectic day. at least it keeps you busy.
Is that really good, Milda? Is that really good?
I think it is good. I mean, yeah. Remember the Bible gives us an instruction to work for 6 days.
So yes.
Any lack of work, you know, if it's not because of extra, something beyond your control,
yeah,
should actually be somebody who is disregarding the instruction.
Ah.
I do not be one of those.
I hear you. That makes sense. I suppose that then helps us to, you know, see the importance of actually being busy throughout the day. Really, really appreciate your time. You know, when I fly Safair, my elder must tell you, one of the things that they, of course, they, I suppose, brag about, and you know, they can't stop telling the world that they always arrive on time. And in the times that I've flown with them, they have arrived on time, I must be honest. I think it was one incident where I was from Cape Town where it was a little bit of a shaky one. But we were like 2 minutes or thereabouts late. But nonetheless, most of the time, they are always on time. So it would be really interesting to explore that with you. And is that a tagline throughout the company?
Because we realize that people really don't have time to waste.
Yeah.
You know, so if you want to be very useful in people's lives, you just need to make sure that you are efficient in all that you do.
Yeah.
So that kind of DNA is the one that we really drive it through the entire organization. I mean, just to give it every lunchtime, well, that's between 1 and 2 work teams at operational level, that discuss each and every flight that we would have done in the previous day.
Sure.
Even if we're delayed by 1 minute, we want to investigate why was that 1 minute delay allowed? Where did we go wrong?
Yeah.
So we are working towards perfection.
Yeah.
And that's the DNA. So that's why it is very important. We have left ministers behind, by the way.
We've
arrived late at the airport and we've left them behind because they've moaned, said, for us, it's a business. We're running a business.
Yeah.
We're not a political entity. We're running a business. I'm sure if there were some angels that were here who came late, they would also be left behind.
So there you go. Angels, be careful. Yeah. You're going to be left behind.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. If your guiding angel is behind you and is late, so they'll leave the boarding gate. Yeah, you'll go alone.
Oh my goodness, that's really beautiful. No, I think I've witnessed one opposition leader at some point who was actually left behind, and he made a thing about it on social media, and everyone was like, "Excellent, you are left behind."
Absolutely. No, we've been very tough, you know, on ourselves and all that, you know.
Yeah.
But that's how we run a business. I mean, you need to be efficient, you need to be professional, and you need to make sure that you treat everybody with the same. You can't have holy cows.
Yeah,
it's a business,
true,
you know?
True. It's a business.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Sure, that's lovely. And I love the fact that it's a culture thing. It's incorporated and inculcated in everyone's mind that you need to be on time. I suppose you don't have staff coming late to work. Those kind of issues are not things that are, you know, a thing at Fly Safair. That's really interesting, I must say. And like you're saying, it fosters a certain type of culture of knowing that you're running a business here and people are busy and time matters. And I suppose there's
absolutely
nothing as bad as an airline that's not taking us serious when I know that I need to land at 8, take my car, hired car, drive, it's an hour, my meeting is at 9. So any minute late is actually bad for my business as well.
Absolutely. I mean, for instance, one of our cultures, for instance, for going to an executive meeting, if you arrive in the executive meeting 5 minutes before the meeting, you are late.
Mm.
So our own time is at least 10 minutes before the meeting.
Sure.
You know, when the CEO walks in, we are all ready.
Yeah.
We are ready. We just need to start the meeting.
Sure.
Anyway, that's on time.
That's on time. Oh, wow. That's really lovely. Now, let's go back, Mild. I want us to take a little bit of a tour back at growing up. And as our shapeshifter, what we try and do with this segment is just get to understand the person behind the person, because I'm sure there are young people looking at you from church, from your workplace and every other place. I mean, just a Google search, your name comes up and people can learn about the work that you've done and what you've accomplished and all that. And some might not necessarily have the chance to actually ask you these questions. When someone comes to you and asks you to define yourself, how do you define yourself?
Well, in a few ways. I mean, the first thing, of course, I'm a Christian and I'm an Adventist.
Yeah.
And I'm a family man.
Yeah.
But when it comes to something relevant to this platform, is that I'm an aviator.
Yeah.
I've been in the aviation industry. That was my first industry I joined when I was 19 years.
Mm.
That was 33 years ago. So I've been in this industry for 3 decades and 3 years.
Sure.
I'm sure half your listeners are not even 30 years old.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But be that as it may, I do have a passion for entrepreneurship as well.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to talk about that when you talk about the money segment part of it. Yeah.
Oh, lovely.
So I have a passion for aviation. I love aviation. And in fact, I think all those that probably enter this industry will realize that it's something that you can't get out of. I went on a few years, but I was already sick. I just came back to it, you know.
That was my question. For 3 decades, why would you stay in this industry for so long?
It becomes part of your DNA.
Yeah.
So I was trained as an aircraft mechanic, technician, or engineer in 1990 to 1995.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was drilled during our training was the fact that you can't have a second chance. You can't make a mistake and expect that something will happen when the aircraft is flying.
Mm.
So that I think that just resonated with my natural instinct. My favorite verse, for instance, is whatever your hands may find to do it with all your might. If you can't put a stamp on whatever that you produce, don't do it. Just stay away from it, you know. Don't be part of mediocre culture. Wait as long as I've done the task. But if the question is, how have you done the task? Have you put all your might into it? So that's one thing that I think I would be quite comfortable to say. I would like to be identified with a quest for perfection, for excellence.
Sure. That's really amazing. Now, where were you born, and what were some of the socio-economic challenges you would remember back in the days?
Well, I was born in Mfakwase, one of the townships in Harare.
Yeah.
Then we obviously moved to a different township again, some area in Chitungwiza. And of course, I think one of the challenges, I mean, we're growing up in a totally different world altogether, you know. I mean, we didn't have these gadgets. We didn't have information at our fingertips.
Yeah.
So I think that environment where you had to work hard for each and everything with nothing being put before you on a silver platter, it seemed to have probably built big, probably stronger characteristics within us. And I ascribe myself to that. And so I grew up in the location. But what was also quite important was that I grew up in an Adventist family. So there was a very strong, you know, Adventist, grilling and indoctrination from an early age, which defined, how you live your life later on.
That makes sense. And how much of that background then? I suppose it sounds like there was some background from a religious point of view, but also from the community in Harare, in Zimbabwe, for people who may not know. You know, there were obviously issues there that you could see here and there. I suppose you could overlay those with and find some comfort in religion, right? In being an Adventist and say, yes, I see what's happening, but there's this hope, there's this whatever. How much of those background issues that you faced as a young person and growing up in Harare and other townships like you've mentioned have contributed to the person that you are? I mean, I grew up in a township myself, and it's very easy to get absorbed into crime, into drugs and all those sort of stuff, because when you go out of your house, you see the very same thing that you're seeing inside your house, which is lack, which is poverty, which is all of these things. And the thought of that can push one into either depression or even sometimes to crime. How has that contributed to the person that you are today?
I must say I was quite fortunate that I had this safeguard of religion.
Mm.
Already around, and in fact, I mean, it's one thing probably that the young people don't probably realize now that fact that you are immersed in religious activities just protects you from anything. So I remember that when I was growing up, I was a very prominent member of my peers.
Okay,
but they actually knew that on a Sabbath, I'm not part of any activities.
Yes.
In fact, I know sometimes that there were times that our soccer matches, remember the soccer matches, the proper soccer matches for the basketball, but I used to be quite useful in that team. So they would actually put some games after Vespers. Well, they would almost like wait outside.
Yeah.
So it's sunset now.
Now you can come out.
They knew that the goals would come. So already that was like a protection for myself. But of course, you realize that, I mean, like I was saying, there was poverty. I mean, we just gained independence. I think we got independence when I was about, 8, 9 years old. And what then defined us going forward was that at that time, there was a strong drive for education. So we saw then adults going to school, some in grade 1, grade 2, they are 40, whatever, because the government, when it came in, it wanted an educated citizenry. And it was quite important for us. So it was almost like we all wanted to get education. Education was the buzzword. And that is why, I mean, if you look at statistics now, Zimbabweans probably have got quite a high percentage of those that have gone through, you know, higher levels of education. So that was the definition. But you would, of course, avoid seeing the poverty just around you in schools and within the family, relatives. I mean, sometimes when you look at the young kids today, what they seem to regard as normal was not normal for them.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you would see a family with 6 kids, they're sharing one bedroom. That was the life.
Yeah.
And here, if they just sleep one night on the floor, if somebody goes into depression. And so you didn't grow up in 1970 or you're lucky.
Yeah. Sure. That makes sense. A religion then providing that cushion for you.
That's safeguard.
It's really amazing. Let's talk about your career then. Do you remember your first job? How was it like?
So my first job was an apprentice.
Okay.
I wasn't intending to be in the aviation industry, by the way. I needed to be in to do apprenticeship. So when I finished my O level, there were two routes that one would follow. Of course, you'd go up to A levels, then you go to varsity. But at that time, apprenticeship was the buzz because there was a stipend.
I see. Good motivator right there.
Absolutely. I wanted to be a fitting tenor.
Okay.
And that phase in my life has always been so encouraging.
Yeah.
Because what I then did, I think I was 18 years old. I just finished my O levels and I was deciding whether I should go to A levels and whatever, but I was applying for apprenticeship. So I took one full day at 18 years old and I went to a mountain that was nearby where we were staying with my Bible. And I spent the whole day reading the Bible, praying, and asking God to give me an apprenticeship opportunity as a fitter and tenor.
Sure.
Can you imagine the response that came? God gave me the response in an aviation industry. So at that time, to be an aircraft fitter, you needed to have, 15 points at A level, upper 6.
Yeah,
I wasn't there.
But sure.
Straight from O level, I got that opportunity to go into aviation. And I always say to myself, I think that moment of prayer in that mountain God opened an avenue that was beyond what I even asked for.
Yeah.
I asked to be a fiddle and tenor. But God said, no, go to the highest level of that apprenticeship trade and go into aviation, which was quite scary. When I was here, we're going through mathematics initially.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand the thing because it was A-level mathematics.
Sure.
And all my colleagues were A-level qualifications. So I bet all of those mathematics, but eventually I pulled through. But I thank God that I had the opportunity to speak to him one-on-one in that mountain.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about exactly that, because you do find that young people are faced with so many things, right? And they go through so many things. And I can go back to even my own experience with mathematics at school and all that. We hated it. We like, what in the world is this thing? And we often joked, like, where am I going to solve for X in life? And you don't realize that, no, actually, it's teaching you something that, you know, you're going to be faced with problems in life and you must always solve for X. And that's how you look. But we're always annoyed at solving for X and all that. And you find that a lot of young people then shied away from mathematics. And it almost becomes a precursor to, you know, shying away from life, even when they become adults. And here's a young man right now, a young person right now who's faced with that, and they have this difficult course, I suppose, that they need to do, but they feel like giving up. What made you not to give up on your mathematics?
I think a few things, Tapil. I think the first thing is that if you don't have a vision of where you see yourself, any point becomes a destination. So, but if you're able to craft a vision for yourself and be able to see the fruits in the horizon, you've got enough motivation to say whatever challenges are here, I should be able to go through them so that I can reach that destination. But again, I like the other point that you mentioned there, which talks about mathematics not being viewed as a subject per se, but as training on how to solve problems in life. Because that's what the teacher gives you a problem.
Exactly.
It solves this problem.
Yes.
So it's not really the mathematics that you should be worried about. The issue is, how do you approach, what is your attitude on solving problems?
Yeah.
So all these exercises will become useful later on in life, not as mathematics. They come with issues in the marriage, with issues in the family, with issues in the community.
Yes.
How do you resolve those?
Yeah.
So if you run away from mathematics, you're probably going to run away from problems that confront you.
Exactly.
Because you've not trained yourself to be able to confront problems and deal with them.
Yeah. I think there's also, you know, this thing that I don't know whether it's an imposter syndrome or whatever, but a lot of young people will go like, because I can't do it, then people leave it and they go away from it and they give up instead of just trying to find a way to solve it. Yes, mathematics is difficult. Yes, maybe accounts is difficult. Yes, maybe engineering is difficult and all those. But like you said, think about later on, have that vision later on in life.
Absolutely.
You know, you're going to be faced with such things that you need to do. And it sounds like, Mael, that the aviation industry is something that you really loved and you kind of have found your way through it. Can you remember now? I see it was an apprenticeship and you then had to work through it. What were some of the positions that you held within the space that you still remember till today?
Yes, of course. So I did my apprenticeship in, I joined the aviation training school in Zim, as in the school in 1990. At that time, it was 5 years to graduate. So I graduated in 1995. But at that time, when I graduated, the Zimbabwean currency was stronger than the rand. So if I had one Zim dollar, I could get two rands. it was 1 to 2. The other way. But I already, before I graduated, I already made up my mind that I wanted to work in South Africa, simply because 75% of the aviation industry, I think it's probably the almost around there, was in South Africa then. And I wanted to be where the greatest activity was. So after I qualified, I finished my apprenticeship, I did not even apply for a job. The next week, I was in a bus to South Africa. I got my pension. I think my pension there was probably about $2,000.
Yeah.
Changed all that into rand.
Yeah.
And I was on the bus. on the bus in November.
That's interesting.
I qualified on the 10th of October.
Yeah.
November, I was on the bus. got a job. We did two.
Yeah.
This was another 1844.
Yeah.
So I got a job in Twister. And the company then says, go and fetch a toolbox. I mean, it was a very heavy toolbox.
Mm.
So I went back to Harare, fetched my toolbox. The guy just said, go and fetch a toolbox and you can start immediately when you arrive.
Mm.
So I came back. I returned to South Africa like mid-December. Then the guy says, you've come too early. Go back and come back in January.
And did you come back in January? Did you go away?
No. I stayed around and looked for a job elsewhere. So I went to a different company. I realized that we were not really serious.
Yeah, true.
So, yeah,
true.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
So I was an apprentice for 5 years. Then I came here in South Africa. Then I worked for Foster Web Aviation. I worked for Nationwide Airlines before they were grounded.
Yeah.
Then from Nationwide, I joined the Civil Aviation Authority.
Yeah.
As an airworthiness inspector, and from there, after 1 year, then I applied for a scholarship to study a master's degree in aircraft aviation safety, aircraft airworthiness in France.
Yeah.
So I went with my family in France for 18 months, came back, and then that's when I started going working at management level. So when I came back in 2002, I then was promoted to senior manager for about 3 months. Then went into executive. So from executive in 2002 right up to now, I've been helping holding executive positions in aviation industry.
Oh, wow. And
leading up to my current position at FlySurfer.
Yes. I was about to say, it must be challenging then to be, I suppose, at that level as an executive. What are some of the challenges in your career that you can think back to?
Well, I think the most recent one was the pandemic.
Sure. Yeah.
You'd realize that our industry was one of the hardest hit by the pandemic.
Yeah.
Because there was a time that we were not able to fly, not because we didn't want to fly, but it was against the law that we could not fly.
Yeah.
But as we discussed, I mean, you realize that when we went to the pandemic, I actually think that at some point I must write a thesis on how FlySurfer handled the pandemic. I was telling my people at that time.
Yeah, you
should. I think when I get a few time, I should be able to write that.
Yeah.
Because I thank God that we came up with strategies that just allowed us not only to survive, but to emerge as the biggest airline in such a short time. I mean, when we went to the pandemic, we were at 23% of the market. During the pandemic, we became 80% of the domestic market.
Oh, wow.
After the pandemic, when everybody came back, we remained around 55-60% of the domestic market.
Oh, wow.
And those that came back then collapsed again.
Yes.
Even those that survived became a small airline.
Yes.
So it's all those strategies that we employed as executives. And for me, actually, it's almost like a template what to do in a pandemic and what not to do in a pandemic.
Yeah.
I mean, just as an overview.
Yeah.
There is one question that we ask, that is our strategy. We ask ourselves, is this pandemic a temporary issue or a permanent issue? If when we answer that it is a temporary issue, then we said we are not going to make permanent decisions
based on a
temporary situation.
Hey.
Most airlines made permanent decisions based on a temporary issue.
Yeah.
So when that temporary issue was removed, they were not ready.
Yes.
Because they ran permanent decisions that are not lasting.
Sure.
I mean, once we retrench people, they retrench people, and when we started flying, we recruited all the crew of the industry.
Yes, yes.
When they're looking for the staff, we had them already. Because they did not treat them well, so we treated our staff very well. We didn't retrench anybody.
Yeah.
We kept everybody.
Yeah.
And we kept on saying, guys, even when we started the pandemic, there were three low-cost airlines, for instance, ourselves, Kulula, and Mango.
Yeah.
And we say, one of the low-cost airlines is not going to survive. And that one airline is not us.
Yes, yes, yes.
So we made that decision already.
Yes.
It's not us.
Yeah.
It's going to be someone else. Guess what happened? Two actually failed and only one remained.
Yes, yes, sure.
So I think that was one of the biggest challenges for us, but it was a very, very good learning curve. Learning curve on how you can deal in any crisis. It could be a marriage crisis. It could be a crisis anywhere. You know, these experiences allow you to be able to handle whatever crisis comes.
Yes, yes.
With a sober heart.
Yes.
A sober head.
Sure. That's lovely. Yeah. There's a comment that says, I'm yet to use Pythagoras' theory in my life. So there you go.
Well, the person who has wrote that has actually used it many times, actually.
Yes.
It was written Pythagoras' theory.
Yeah.
It was written marriage issue. It was written work relative issue.
Yeah.
It was written something else.
Yeah.
Not Pythagoras.
Yeah.
But he has done much more than Pythagoras, I can tell you.
Ah, so I get what you're saying. Instead of using Pythagoras, use the problem. You will see that actually
absolutely.
That problem and Pythagoras have the same issues there that you need to deal with. I get you.
Absolutely.
I get you. I'm with you there. And also sending a fire emoji there, saying making permanent decisions about temporal situations. There's a life lesson. And I was about to say that exactly, to say from your own experience there with the work that you had to do at Fly Safair and solving for a problem that you had to ask yourself, is it temporal? Or is it permanent? And then you made decisions based on that. And it reminds me, my elder, to say, you know, if you look at the pharmaceutical industry on its own, there are some that made permanent decisions something that was temporary. And today, a lot of them had to return stuff because they thought, okay, we're going to be producing vaccines forever and ever and ever and ever. But no, it wasn't forever and ever and ever and ever. And today, some of them are retrenching in the pharmaceutical space and have to reconfigure again. And I think you would agree with me that reconfiguring again costs a lot of money and time.
And besides that, Tapelo, your competitors have already gone.
Exactly. You left behind.
They are fit. I mean, that was the issue that the airlines, remember, they also came back. But when they came back, we had already entrenched ourselves in the market. Number one, they probably did not give refunds to passengers. So passengers had tickets that were not given refunds back.
Yeah.
And when we went to the pandemic, we said, guys, we'd rather be broke, but let's give back people their money or their voucher.
Yeah.
So we never owned anybody.
Yeah.
So we had that trust now to say, this airline is credible.
Yeah.
They don't run away with people's money.
Yeah.
But besides that, they're also on time, by the way.
That's very important. That's very, very important. And like you're saying, you know, when customers are gone, it's very difficult to get them back. So they all moved to Fly Safair because the other ones were not available for them when they needed those flights and all that. And Fly Safair was there just catching, I suppose, as they would normally say in business, fruits that were just hanging for anyone to catch there.
So Tapelo, if an animal kills a human being, it must be put down.
Yeah, true.
So we always say it to ourselves during that time. Any new passenger who flies us to be finding difficult flight with somebody else on your operate. So they should not go anywhere else. And I think that on that basis. Because many passengers here, they've flown with Fly Safair because I think we're just suspicious. Oh, it is all these people and whatever.
Yeah.
But when they flew with us during that time, when there's no other opportunity to fly with anybody else, they then realize that, oh, here's actually a product that can be,
Exactly.
We didn't waste that opportunity. We never wasted that opportunity.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about the high points in your career. What one high point would you single out?
Sure. It's quite interesting. quite a few, but maybe let me just start with the maybe most recent one, just before the pandemic. The industry is heavily regulated by the Civil Aviation Authority. So they do have their awards, like industry awards. They are also going to be happening sometime in November this year.
Yeah.
So this was the second round, and they had, I think, about maybe 14 different categories.
Yeah.
So with these awards, you enter the categories, and then you put together a motivation for each and every category, why you think you should be considered.
Yeah.
So we enter these categories, and that will remain a highlight in my life because the entering of those categories were coordinated within my department. So we then went there, about 12 of us. Of the 14 categories, we scooped 8. And we named the aviation company of the year. It was just incredible. I mean, we were, after every award, you just hear the finalists are Fly Surfer, so-and-so. And the winner is Fly Surfer. To the extent that our CEO then said, guys, let's not go back to the table. Let's just wait by the stage.
Yeah.
Because otherwise they're going to call us back again. So that was one of the highlights.
That's amazing. Like 8 out of 12 is like 66% or thereabouts.
Yeah, so this year we are defending those awards because I think during the pandemic. So if we chat around December, I'll tell you what the outcome is.
Definitely. We are going to have
I get a suspicion that we might retain quite a few.
I think I also have the same suspicion. Right? Let's talk about money before we run out of time. Yeah. How would you describe your relationship with money?
Well, very tricky question. Obviously, I'm not related to money. I wish I was more closely. You see, for me, I tend to look on the long term goals.
Okay,
that has been my approach to look at the long term goals.
Yeah,
and this has been driven probably by also my experience when I realized the change of the economic situation probably in Zim. Now, I'll tell you what I mean by this. So sometime like 10 years ago, I already started looking at how am I going to live in retirement when I'm 65?
Yeah.
How am I going to be living in retirement? So I already said to myself, we need to have a plan that will ensure us we maintain our living standard right now, even into pension, without really bothering other people or anybody for that matter.
Yeah.
So that and this is driven by what I saw happening in Zim. People had accumulated huge pensions, and when the economy started to somersault, those huge pensions meant nothing. People were crying because old mutual could not even afford to send a statement with the money that used to be a lot of money then. So from that time, I got a very good lesson. And one of the issues that I've always thought would be important for me would have been to make sure that by the time I retire, there is a property portfolio that sustains me.
Yes.
Because I've realized that property would always be current with whatever the economy is like.
Yeah.
I would rather have property than have financial muscle as liquid cash. Because I know that it can vanish.
Yeah.
The economy, it's at the mess of the economy. But I could old school, but with property, then you're able to still absorb those shocks there. So that's how I've also prepared for that. But I also feel that at that time, even though I may not know what to do with it, I just think that I must have a farm.
Yes.
I must have time at a farm. Yeah. You know, land is quite important.
Yes.
Land, you know.
Yeah.
Have the land. Find out what you're going to do about it later. But it must be there.
It must be there.
For me, it's something that is not negotiable.
Yes.
It must just be there and you'll find something to do about it.
So that's
how I think, I look mainly on long-term goals.
Yeah.
They have also been not very good financially, I must say. I mean, if I look at some of the decisions that I've made, the first house that we bought in South Africa around in 1996, it was for 193,000.
Sure.
193,000.
Yeah.
So when we're upgrading, going to another, we sold that house.
Mm.
You know, we sold it for 680,000 or something. I saw it on the market not long ago. It's probably going for about 2.8.
Sure.
That was the most crazy decision that we could do.
Sure.
I mean, that house, we could pay it now probably in a week.
Exactly.
Why sell that property? Why? You know, even that 680,000, I can't see it because then you went to the cost of registering this property.
Yes.
It was the most crazy decision ever. And I say to somebody, if you are going to dispose of a property, there must be proper analysis of what that means before you just jump into that. So that's one of the crazy things that I think I could have done better.
You could have done better. All right.
Yeah.
We've got about 3 minutes, but I want to ask this one in this 3 minutes. What lessons do you teach your kids about money?
Sure. Quite a difficult subject because I still think that I could have done much better when it comes to that lesson.
Yeah.
But one thing that happened with, especially as a child, to allow you to fast financially independently.
Mm.
In some cases, for instance, I mean, I know I wanted to buy a space car.
Mm.
I really watched my son from afar because I wanted that financial discipline to be built in him to say, I'm not going to get something on a silver platter, but I want that financial discipline that says I need to save.
Mm.
After I've saved, I'm able to whatever it was.
Mm.
I'm not sure. But that's one of the things that I've always said to myself. Kids need to understand their financial responsibilities and obligations and start working on that.
Mm.
And one of the simplest things, by the way, is just to make sure that they function with a budget.
Mm.
It can't be like finder in a snooker game where you just hit the ball and expect it to go somewhere. It must be properly do a budget.
Yes.
Even if, for instance, you fail to keep it, continue doing a budget kind of financial is one that would be quite useful.
What advice would you give to your younger self?
Well, I think I should have started saving early, very, very early. And I think it was also good that one of the cars that I bought was a brand new car. But when I look at it, maybe one or a few others, but when I look at it, I actually felt that I could have taken better decisions then, and probably spend the resources in a different way. So I think for me, I'm saying to the young person, live within your means. Don't go into debt in order to keep up with the Joneses. Don't go into debt because everybody else is driving this car. Everybody else is wearing these labels. We don't even see those labels. Just be yourself.
Yeah.
If a tie is 100 rands in 8 cars, the same tie could be, I don't know, maybe 1,000 rands elsewhere. Just believe in yourself. I mean, one of the things that I've always said is that don't allow yourself to be defined by what you have or what is on you. You know, be defined because of who you are. It's almost like anything. I mean, I was saying to one of my colleagues about your self-esteem.
Yeah.
To say, the moment you see it necessary to announce to your family or to your wife that you are the husband, that day you have ceased to be husband.
You have ceased, yeah.
Husband is not described by position, just act as a husband, because believe in yourself. So I'm saying to the young people, just live a life that is simple, a life that is affordable, a life that is less stressful. I mean, death, for instance, Sister White says, that time, run away from death as if it's leprosy.
Yeah.
It is indeed leprosy.
Yeah.
Run away from death. Imagine what life it is. And I'm saying to myself, I wish I'd run away from debt much earlier. Maybe the hair would not be a bit gray.
Yeah.
It would be extremely black.
Sure. No, we've captured that. Well, my elder, we've run out of time. Like you said, we need to check with you around December again and see how things have panned out, especially at those
awards.
Your
call has been placed on hold.
Although I do think, he has placed us on hold. My elder, can you hear me?
I can hear you, sorry. Yes,
No problem. I was saying that we've run out of time, but I'm sure around December we'll check in with you once again. I do have a sense that the Lord is going to give you those awards again. So we'll be checking in with you to just say, hey, we see that you got the awards. But thank you so much for taking the time and joining us this evening. I've written a lot on my page, and I know that our listeners as well have learned a lot from you as our shapeshifter for today. May God bless you and family. And as always, it's always good to chat to you.
Thank you so much, and good night.
Thank you so much. That was our elder. I mean, I enjoyed talking to him, I must tell you. And he was talking to us about his life and where he started. Great insights there.
You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
Well, of course, that brings us to the end of the show. Thank you so much to Elder Chakarisa there. He exudes what he's saying. You know, when he speaks about excellence, you can see it in his own life. And if you are looking at it just from a career point of view, from a family point of view, from goals and life and all those sort of things, you can see that in him. So thank you so much to our elder for talking to us today. He was our shapeshifter. Thank you so much to Monde Lot Ndlovu. Always a great pleasure to talk to him, I must tell you, off and on air as well. Great mind there, and we really appreciate him. And thank you so much to you as well for joining us this evening and being part of the show. It is the last installment for this particular week, but we're back again tomorrow. No, not tomorrow. We're back again next week. Look at me. I'm trying to extend myself. Hey, management. Maybe they must give me another day. Monday to Friday. Let's do this. Let's do this, but you do know that Bible Perspective will be with you tomorrow between 6 and 8 p.m. Enkosi, realebora, siyabonga, halebukhahle, baya danki, merci beaucoup, asante sana for joining us this evening. We really appreciate it, and of course, we shall continue to have this conversation on our platforms, +27734703520. My name is @Tapelo_Malai_SA. For the last time this week, @Tapelo_Malai_SA. That's where you can find me on our social media platforms. But until next week, may God bless you and keep you. May he cause his countenance to so shine upon you and give you peace. Till you meet next time. Good night.
You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.